Hello, and welcome to the Skeleton Factory Podcast, episode 72. This is Adam coming to you from Austin, Texas, and it is still October. Halloween is right around the corner, and today I wanted to talk about a film that I think is perfect for the month of October. It's perfect for any gloomy day. It's perfect for the Halloween season. And it's perfect if you're a lover of movies. This film is based upon historical fact. The principal characters lived, and the major events depicted in the film actually took place. This is the opening text to Ken Russell's 1971 masterpiece, The Devils. The Devils, starring Oliver Reed and Vanessa Redgrave. A movie based on the book The Devils of Loudon by Aldous Huxley. A book that I think has its place next to A Brave New World and Orwell's 1984 as one of those books people should be referencing when real-life political corruption, religious persecution, and kangaroo courts are set up to tear down political opponents. It's an example of what does it look like when free people become less free. We open with a dramatic stage performance of Louis XIII, depicting Botticelli's The Birth of Venus. It's shocking, and it's in the sense that all of the characters are played by men, including Venus, portrayed by Louis XIII himself. From my research, there is no accuracy to Louis XIII being an effeminate gay man, but that's how he's depicted in this film. But the opening scene is visually stunning, like the rest of the film, and like most Ken Russell films. This scene is something to the effect of, if the Goodbye Horses scene from Silence of the Lambs was in the Smashing Pumpkins Tonight Tonight music video. Just try to meld those two together in your mind. And The Birth of Venus, the painting, carried its own controversy in its day for being the first secular painting to show nudity. Before that, depictions of nudity were of the sin of Eve in primarily religious art, because that's where Eve would primarily be depicted, right? This performance was for the audience of Cardinal Richelieu. Cardinal Richelieu is the true antagonist of this film and the book, and I guess of real life, since this is based on true events. And Cardinal Richelieu wishes to demolish the fortified walls of the French city of Loudon, the last standing Protestant community in France. But Cardinal Richelieu has a problem. King Louis promised not to touch Loudon. Loudon remained loyal to France during the 30 Years' War and posed no threat to the crown or the Catholic Church. But Richelieu is hatching a workaround, a devious plan to destroy Loudon anyways. He wants a melding of church and state to become this all-encompassing, all-powerful government. So this is the setup to The Devils. Now, the first 10 minutes is like a clinic on how to introduce key characters into a story. And enter Father Urbain Grandier. Father Grandier is played by Oliver Reed, who is a regular in Ken Russell films. You may recognize him from Gladiator. That's where I, I think that's where probably where I first saw Oliver Reed. He played the character of Proximo. Proximo was a gladiator who won his freedom and became a free man after being chosen by Marcus Aurelius. He was chosen because the crowd loved him, and obviously he killed a lot of people in the Colosseum. And Marcus Aurelius gave him his freedom. And the whole point of Gladiator is that the Maximus character, his vision of what Marcus Aurelius saw as this dream of what Rome is and should be, and it must be realized. So even in his small part in Gladiator, Oliver Reed's character is fantastic. I want to say even before that, actually, before that, Oliver Reed is actually in the Ken Russell film Tommy. You know, the movie based on the Who album of the same name. That's actually where I seen him first. Anyways, so Father Grandier is a very popular Protestant priest in Loudun. And after his predecessor died from the plague, he is now in charge. He's now the new governor, mayor, religious leader of Loudun. And though self-governing, Loudun and Grandier remain loyal to the church and to the king. But Grandier is especially popular with the ladies. His one weakness, really, is women, and would ultimately be his downfall. Grandier is lusted after by the local convent of nuns, headed by its mother superior, Sister Jeanne, played by Vanessa Redgrave, who hides her infatuation with Grandier probably better than most. Her and all of the other nuns live in this white tiled, not completely historically accurate. Most of the city of Loudun is not precisely historically accurate, but it's fine. It's totally fine. It still gets the point across of the time that they're in, and adds a sense of scale and epicness. For instance, the walls of Loudun, instead of portraying them as this kind of gray, moss-covered stone castle of a city, it's portrayed in this, like, pristine, brand new, smooth, white wall, like limestone, like walls, towering walls, with very epic, sort of brutalist-looking architecture. And from what I understand, Loudun was not exactly the construction of the fortified walls of Loudun, I think at the time, were fairly new anyways. So they wanted to have the impression of a sort of modern, a modern city. But yes, getting back to Vanessa Redgrave, Sister Jeanne, all the nuns under her control, and she was a rather, the real Sister Jeanne was a relatively young head of a convent. So, like, she was a rather young woman. She wasn't this old, you know, seasoned nun or anything like that. But she has very complex fantasies of Grandier. Now, she's hunchbacked, okay? And her affliction taints her even her most private fantasies. And she prays to God to take away the hump in her back. And she seems to be quite the dedicated servant of God. But her repressed sexual desires have sort of drove her to madness. I guess that would be the best way to describe her character through the film. So even, again, in her own private sexual thoughts, she knows Grandier is sort of unobtainable. And her fantasies are fantastic. There's a scene of she's walking through a crowd of people. She has very, very long hair, like almost like Rapunzel length hair. She's in a long sort of robe kind of gown. And there's a crowd of people witnessing the crucifixion of Christ. And when she approaches, the Christ figure morphs into a crucified Father Grandier. And it's very epic. And when she approaches, he sort of has this, it's almost like he levitates off of the cross and is standing before her. And there's one where he's walking across water and I'm conflating my sister Jean fantasies. The scene where he walks across water, when he gets to shore, that's where she has the very long hair, and she like dries his feet with her hair, and they proceed to violently roll on the ground in front of this crowd in sort of a lustful manner. But she still, even in her fantasies, her hunchback comes even into like her insecurity about it. Creeps into her fantasies, which I find really interesting. And I guess her thoughts are, hey, who wants to fuck a hunchback? Even in fantasy world. Father Grandier is massively charming. And it's sort of his, I guess, pride, really, that brings him to, well, really, Grandier's downfall from power is threefold. Okay. First, he has a sexual relationship with the cousin of one of the other priests in Loudun, Father Mignon. And the young lady named Philippe, she's rather smitten with Grandier, as most women in Loudun are, but she confesses to Grandier that she is pregnant. Now, what is this young lady doing in the private chambers of the head priest, the head politician, the head guy of this town, and no one notices? Well, Grandier is supposed to be, he's supposed to be giving her Latin lessons, which he is, but also gives her a lesson in birth control. He gets her pregnant. She tearfully comes to him with this information. Post-coitus, by the way. Ay, ay, ay. And he tells her, look, I can't help you. I don't know what it is that you want from me, but he's like, given my position and my station in life, my profession, my dedication to the cloth and, you know, the country, I can't be fathering a child. And it's not like he tries to have her try to get rid of the baby. He doesn't try to get her to lie or be quiet about how or who impregnated her, sort of thing. He's very much like, look, like, tell your father the truth of what happened, and perhaps he can find, he can help you find a good man and to, you know, help be the father of your children. He's like, there are good men out there, you know. And then he says, take my hand. And she takes his hand. And he's like, you feel that? It's like feeling the dead. And then just storms off and is like, you need to get out of my place. But I don't know. De Grandier's swagger is absolutely fascinating. And even confessed to Philippe's cousin, the priest, Father Mignon. There's a scene, another beautiful scene, where Father Grandier is blessing an open pit, a mass grave of bodies, all victims of the plague. And they're stacked in this hole, huge hole. And he's walking and he's throwing holy water and blessing it. And Father Mignon's with him. And he's like, yeah, my cousin is pregnant. He's like, you know, Grandier, you have your whores. Why do you have to fuck around with my cousin, who's just some, you know, kind of well-to-do rich girl, who's just another, you know, another girl in this town that has a crush on you. And Grandier basically tells him, in a much more flowery, articulate way, that he's like, you know, Mignon, he's like, I like sex, and, you know, I basically don't find it to be a sin, insofar as, you know, in a traditional manner. He's like, I still am a servant of God, but I know that my pride, my lustful actions will eventually be my undoing. And I do these things anyways. So he sort of foreshadows in the most crystal clear way. He's just like, yeah, he's like, I know I'm kind of a horn dog and I'm silky smooth with the ladies and everything like that. And I know it'll probably end, it'll end badly for me, but whatever, man, we have a city to save. Okay. So sort of the second thing that sort of becomes Grandier's downfall, his sister Jeanne's obsession with Grandier. Sort of her obsession with him has sort of led her to madness. And this madness has spread to the rest of the nuns in the convents. They are already at their own accord. Sort of everyone's sort of has this infatuation with Grandier. And they're all the other nuns are, for the most part, young, you know, young women, you know, in the peak of their sexual prime, but they are in service of God. Okay. There's no sex time for nuns, right? It doesn't mean that they can't, you know, have lustful thoughts and all. Oh, and there is a there's many layers to this movie, and I'll try to hit on as many of them as I feel makes sense. Sister Jeanne wanted Father Grenier to become the confessor for the convent. I don't know why he wasn't already, given that the convent is inside the city of Loudun, and you actually see inside the church another set that's amazing, and he's giving confession, and of course all the people he confesses to are all women who just need an excuse to go to confession every single week just so they can kind of talk to the dreamy Father Grenier. But I guess if you're a confessor, you are, I guess, more specifically in service to the convent, I suppose. So she's trying to get Grenier to be the main confessor for the convent, which would be great for her because then she gets to see Grenier all the time and she gets to confess her fantasies and desires, and that's kind of part of her fantasy, right? And Sister Jeanne, I mean, her lustful fantasies are just constantly swelling up, constantly bubbling over. You know, we have scenes of her masturbating. We have scenes of her masturbating in her private quarters, where another nun is sort of spying on her, but not in a snitch type of way, but in a way where she's like, in kind of a lesbian type of way. She's like, ooh, I know, Sister Jeanne masturbates on the regular, and I kind of like to spy on her while she's doing it, and you could tell she likes that as well. So there's... this movie's filled with sexual tension, okay? It's the classic two great tastes that taste great together situation in The Devils. You have sex and you have violence. And everything in between is just, you know, gravy and tasty garnish, if you will, okay? You know, you have the plague, you have, you know, sort of a religious drama, you have heresy, you have all these fantastic things going on. Getting back to Sister Jeanne's obsession with Grenier, she sends a letter off to Grenier saying like, oh, you need to come be the confessor for the convent, and she's told that a priest is there to meet with her, and she's like, you know, oh, it's Grenier, and she runs to see who it is, and the convent itself looks like a prison. You know, the set design is immaculate. You know, you think a 17th century convent, you think of sort of epic churches, you think of ornate pillars and stonework and gargoyles and stained glass windows, or you know, whatever it is that you think. It's like not even like that at all. The place is, you know, it's just like white subway tiles and small windows that are in really awkward positions. They're rather really too low to the ground or way too high for a normal person to see without the assistance of a ladder or something. And the windows have bars over them. So it really kind of subconsciously cements the idea of this convent being like, you know, it's yes, they want to imprison themselves within the walls of the convent to keep out the sin and the evil and the disease and the sort of the dark parts of the world out so they have their clean white space to pray and, I don't know, ruminate about the Lord and whatever. But also it keeps people out as well. And when she runs to go see if Grandier is there to meet with her, it turns out it's Father Mignon, who's not nearly as easy on the eyes as Father Grandier. So she's like, and Father Mignon, he looks like a very, he looks like a rail thin Alan Cummings with a bowl cut. Okay. So she's like, what are you doing here? Where's Father Grandier? And he's like, oh, Father Grandier cannot make it. He's a very busy man. And she's like, what the fuck? I didn't send for you. I sent for Grandier. And he's like, well, I'm going to be the convent's new confessor. And she's like, are you fucking serious? And she kind of has like a mental break at this point. And there's also she receives news that Grandier got married in secret. He had a secret wedding. And that's a whole part of that sort of builds on Grandier's sort of like lust and pride and all that sort of thing. But it also is the thing that's driving Sister Jeanne crazy. Now, as soon as she has her mental break, she immediately is, she starts to go noticeably mad. And this behavior is interpreted as demonic possession, with that kind of negative attention, you're going to have people, inquisitors, if you will, coming around. And I mean, things snowball, one thing leads to another. And next thing you know, this, you know, any mention of possession or anything like that, you're going to have, you're going to have witch finders sniffing around. And, you know, the smallest amount of interrogation in those situations has been known to lead to, let's say, false confessions. And at one point, she does tell Father Mignon that she's been having sexual thoughts about Grandier, that his, I don't know, like his, a form of him, like his, like a specter of him or something, like his essence comes to her at night. And just the way she words it sounds out like Grandier has some type of magical powers or something like that, like he's a vampire or something. This leads to Grandier's kind of third piece of his downfall. This being Grandier's nerve to stand up against a paranoid and unjust would-be tyrant, specifically Cardinal Richelieu. And Cardinal Richelieu is looking for any excuse he can to take down Grandier, because he tells Louis XIII, like, you know, Loudon is kind of the last Protestant strongholds in France, and they have a very fortified city. And if there was going to be some type of uprising or something like that, you know, Loudon, they have a certain amount of military might, and they have a well-protected city. We should strip them of that, just in case they try to rise up against us, because they went through these decades of war. There's been just ample amounts of death from the plague. So Cardinal Richelieu, very paranoid guy, very paranoid. If fabricated stories about demonic possession of a convent inside of Loudon, if stories of a convent becoming possessed and the possession is brought on by Father Grandier. You know, if they take these nuns, it's like, tell us who is this figure of a man that comes to you in the night with lustful intentions. Who is this? He must be in league with the devil. He must be in league with Satan. Who is this? And of course, Sister Jeanne says, it's Father Grandier. Not good. And that's all the ammunition Cardinal Richelieu needed to go after Grandier. So then we enter in the kangaroo courts. We bring in the witch finder general type characters. We have all of that stuff starting to snowball. And we also have the fact that he fornicated and impregnated some young woman whose father has a certain amount of influence to a degree. Now, even though, how do I even equate it? So, Cardinal Richelieu is sort of like the emperor in Star Wars, okay? He's the dude who, like, lays back in the cut. He's, just sits on a throne in the shadows. And his sort of Darth Vader henchman is the character of Baron Ludbardemont. And Ludbardemont is sort of the guy who shows up with an army, with horses, with military might, and he rolls into Loudun, and he's really the one who's like, I'm here to tear down your walls. I'm here to basically disarm Loudun for the safety of France. And Grandier challenges him and says, you can't do that. Only the king could do such a thing. Basically threatens Ludbardemont. He's basically like, you remove a single stone from our walls and you'll be dead before it hits the ground. Ludbardemont is basically like, all right, fine. Because he realizes like, oh shit, I'm about to get fucking killed here. He's like, all right, you know what? I will be back. We'll get the king to come around and we'll be back and you'll be in fucking trouble when we get back and we're going to fuck this place up when I do come back, sort of thing. So he takes off, and that coupled with, Mignon goes and talks to Sister Jeanne. Mignon tells Ludbardemont, and now they're like, okay, cool. We need to send this sort of, Inquisitor, okay? They're going to have their own little Inquisition going on here. So they bring in Father Barre. And Father Barre comes in with the most ridiculous outfit. His outfit looks like if he went to Spirit Halloween store and bought, like, priest who does kung fu or something. He's got this very weird outfit on. But he's basically the guy who's going to come in and he's going to question all of the nuns using all of his, basically his interrogation methods he's like a witch doctor or something like that. Like, none of his interrogation methods, they're not particularly well thought out. They're just like, it's sort of the old Salem witch trial sort of thing, where it's like, we'll take the woman and we will hold her underwater. Okay? We will hold the woman underwater for an extended period of time. And when we pull her back up, if she is still alive, then she is a witch. And we will deal with the witch then. But if she drowns, then we know that she is, in fact, a human being. He's like, Father Barre, sort of like that sort of thing, but he's got all these weird kind of methods. You know, there's this weird doctor in town, and Barre sort of uses them to give all the nuns like these weird enemas with these giant syringe looking things. So they make this like weird potion, this like milky, looks like milk with twigs floating in it, and they suck it into this giant metal syringe thing and give Sister Jean, I guess, enemas to clear out whatever the fuck is inside of her. Apparently, that will help get somebody to give you a honest confession of their of their bewitched activities, I suppose. So Father Barre really is the one who completes the cycle of having all of these young nuns with all these sexually repressed feelings within them that are being led by this crazy nun. Like, he's basically like, you are no longer responsible for your actions. We could just kill all of you now, but instead we want you to just act as crazy as you want. You can do so without consequence. We're getting into this like Milgram experiment sort of situation here, where this authority figure who comes in, he's this he's like a specialist priest, okay? You know, there's all the other priests are sort of, they're like regular. Imagine like a primary care doctor. That's like your standard priest. Like Mignon is a standard primary care type of priest, okay? And Grandier is sort of like, I don't know, what would he be like? He would be like, you know, he'd be like a specialist, okay? Like a sex therapy specialist. And Father Barre, his sort of thing is, what would he be like? He would be sort of like, I guess, any other type of satanic panic weirdo. You know, it's like everything's the devil and everything can possess you and it's all around us and only I can come in and exorcise the devils from within you and from all through the out of the very walls of the city. Okay, that's kind of Barre's position. So shortly after this, the nuns are in a full, total frenzy. Okay, except for Sister Jean. Sister Jean is like, I mean, she's like tied to the ceiling by ropes. Okay. And she's the one that's sort of being held responsible for this coven of nuns going insane, even though that's clearly not the case. And they're stripping their clothes off and they're naked and they're running around and they're, having sex with each other. And now we're kind of getting into some of the controversy of the devils, which I'll touch on briefly. And that's two very specific things that were cut from the original film. And one of them was in the nun's frenzy. So we have crazy music. We have crazy visuals. There's naked women running around. It looks like some kind of like, it looks like a weird hippie cult or something like that. But they're having sex with each other. They're in the church, right? So they... huge statue of Christ, huge statue of the crucifixion of Christ. They knock the crucifix down, and it's huge, by the way. It's massive. It's like 12 feet long. They knock it down, and they begin sort of writhing naked. Sort of the idea is that they're masturbating with the statue of Christ. So you have naked women, totally naked, who are nuns, grinding and sort of masturbating and writhing all over this statue of Christ. that's one of the things that was pulled out of the film. And the devils, pretty much the amount of people who have actually seen the original cut is, you know, I don't know. It could, who knows? It could be less than two handfuls worth of people who have seen it. Because the movie's owned by Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers won't release the full unedited copy of the film to this day. This is a 1971 film, and Warner Brothers still won't release the uncut version of the film. So now we have all these women going crazy. Father Barre is making it worse. You know, he's stirring up all these women into an absolute crazed state. And King Louis pays a visit while all this is going on. Okay. And if you ever seen, there's a lot of really great depictions of this story, by the way, in play form. And when you watch the movie, you can kind of see, like, oh yeah, this, I could see this being based on a play. You know, it's like The Whale, except it doesn't suck. and also, one of, I know that there's video, I know it's definitely on YouTube, there's video of, for my money, my favorite composer probably ever, Krzysztof Penderecki. He did a complete opera based on The Devils of Loudun. And all this stuff is portrayed in the opera, which I completely recommend. It's like, if you see the movie, check out the opera too. You know, it's like, if you're not really into opera, but Penderecki's music is so intense, you know, it just adds to the madness of the story. And I just can't recommend it enough. And I'll take a... Let me just take a moment. Krzysztof Penderecki, okay? You want to talk about sort of masters of movie scores, of, you know, not just soundtracks, but creating music that just immortalize film. You have your... You know, your Bernard Herrmann's and your, Tangerine Dream and John Carpenter. Even people like, you know, Tom York and Johnny Greenwood. But Harry Manfredini. But for me, for my money, the master... Because there's a lot of great musicians out there making music for movies. But to me, the one who stands above them all, the true master, the Yoda, is Krzysztof Penderecki. He's written and composed music. Well, his specialty is basically like horrific historical moments that he forms into music. Okay. And I can totally go on a deeper rant about Penderecki and, you know, him being, you know, a Polish composer and composing music in a country at a time that was basically an authoritarian government, you know. Like, his music was, that was his punk rock, okay? Like, his music was an anti-authoritarian type of music. But, of course, he couldn't really have words. He couldn't have titles that spoke ill of the government or anything like that. Instead, he made music that was so confrontational that he was able to kind of, fly under the radar of the Polish government for a very long time. And was able to make a really powerful, powerful body of work. But yeah. Penderecki's The Devils of Loudon opera. Who's really into opera? No, I'm trying to push an opera to you right now. And I'm not like, you know, some opera enthusiast or anything like that. But please go check out The Devils of Loudon, Penderecki's opera. You know, there's footage of it out there in the world. Die Teufel von Loudon. If, and let's get back to where we were. So Louis XIII shows up to Loudon, but he is in disguise. This is also in the opera. He's disguised as Duke Henry de Conde. Okay. He's, so he comes, you know, presumably at the wishes of the king, but it's not him. It's actually the king himself, right? He shows up and he's in this ridiculous outfit and he's being carried in on like a bed, being fed fruit. Okay, and he's wearing like a mask. And he takes a look around and he's just like, holy fuck, you guys fucking party here in Loudon, huh? He sees all these naked nuns running around masturbating on effigies of Christ. But here's the thing about King Louis, especially in this movie. King Louis is, like I mentioned earlier, he's portrayed as this effeminate, perhaps trans, just very effeminate man who loves the company of artistic types, dancers, actors, you know, that's his shit. So he shows up in Loudon, he sees all these women going crazy. He's just like, oh wow, this is kind of cool. Because his whole thing is, yes, Cardinal Richelieu is trying to get in the ear of the king, so, and you know, create this church and state mega empire sort of thing. But you know, the movie basically depicts, you know, the king is sort of like, you know, he loves indulgence, you know, he loves spectacle, and he's just, he understands that the church is a necessary component to an empire, but he's not a church-going guy. You know, like a lot of leaders in the world. So, like, there's one scene where he's in this giant green field, and he's basically has these little kind of simple single-shot pistols, right? And Richelieu is sitting there like, yes, we need to do something about, we need to tear down Loudon, and we need to take it over, and they may start an uprising, whatever. And King Louis is like, yes, but we promised our dearly departed predecessor of Loudon that we wouldn't touch a single stone of theirs, and we don't want to break our promise, and da 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 da. And Richelieu is like, yeah, no, I know, but let's fuck it up anyways. And meanwhile, the king, he has these little pistols, and you see him like shooting off into the distance. You don't know what he's shooting at. And then it cuts to what he's shooting at. And he has somebody, probably a prisoner or something, dressed up in this ridiculous looking bird costume in a cage. And they open the cage door, and the guy in the bird costume just starts running, and he's sort of being herded down a path by other people with guns. And Louis just sitting there, and he's fucking shoots the guy, and the guy just falls into a pond. And next to the pond on the shore is like another dead guy dressed as a bird. Now, again, probably not historically accurate, but that's okay, because it's Ken Russell. Ken Russell likes to get a little ridiculous with things, and it's not so much to be historically accurate, but to give you the emotional feeling of the sense of power and the power dynamic that's taking place, especially in that scene, in the shooting the dude in the bird suit scene. You see that, like, Louis's all powerful. He's sort of basking in, like, hey, we won the fucking war, and, you know, we've... The Catholic, will have, you know, that, you know, now the Catholic Church can, you know, be unchallenged, and I can be the king and everything like that, and I can satisfy all the indulgences I ever wanted to indulge, and it's, everything's just great, you know. But it gives you a sense of also that life at this point was kind of seen as life was cheap. All right. You had a plague that wiped out a lot of people. You had war that wiped out a lot of people. And being, you know, these two guys just sitting in this field talking, these are two guys who are just like, hey, man, you know, if you're gonna make a frittata empire, you got to crack a shitload of eggs. You know, it's just what it is. As long as we retain our power, like, whatevs, man. Let me just finish up the part of, like, so Louis shows up to Ludon. There's, like, non-lesbian orgies taking place. You know, there's this mad inquisitor driving everybody fucking crazy. The head nun is tied to the ceiling, and she's being injected in her rectum with like potions in enema form to remove the devil from her. And so King Louis shows up in disguise, and he's like, at one point, he's like, ah, Father Barre. He's like, I bring to you this holy item. And this holy item contains, I think he even referred to it as a pile of the blood of Christ from the crucifixion. And Barre is like, what? Like, he comes over, he's like, what? Oh my God. Oh my God. How sensational. Oh my goodness. My Lord. Let's see this. And the other nuns hear this too. And, like, they're totally insane. And he's like, I have this little gold box, and within it is the blood of Christ. And this blood, once it's exposed to the room, every demon shall be vanquished from it, sort of thing. And all the nuns are like, what? And everyone kind of snaps out of their insanity for a second, and they gather around this box, Duke Conde, or King Louis in disguise, he opens the box and then tips it upside down, and it's empty. And and he's basically like, yeah, he's like, I just made that part up. He's like, but he points out, he's like, look at all of you. You guys are acting possessed. You guys are acting insane. You guys are having a fucking nun orgy in a church, and everyone's screaming, and... You know, I just the very mention of, ooh, here's a little idol or a token that has very powerful religious significance. If it's even exposed in your presence in this room, it'll just drive out Satan himself. And then he's like, I was just fucking around. It's just, he points out, like, how ridiculous they're behaving. But then again, he's like, hey, you know, sometimes we got to act ridiculous. Whatevs, it's fine, whatever. You know, he's like, I'm a pervert too. So sometimes you got to get your nut off, right? And so after this, where's Grandier this whole time? Great question. Grandier, okay, so he took off with his lady, this lady named Madeline, who's this lovely lady. And she was part of the reason why Sister Jeanne went insane, right? So her mother, I believe her mother was dying from the plague. And she goes to Grandier and is like, please come, mother's sick sort of thing. And he goes up into their room and it's this crazy scene where there's like a surgeon and doctor guy who just basically practice witchcraft, really. They like voodoo shit. And this woman's insane. She seems to be in a lot of pain. She's writhing around naked on a bed. And they're using those like glass kind of ball, kind of glass cups, you know, for cupping. You know, you've seen people do cupping where they heat up the cup and they put it all over your body and it's supposed to draw blood to the surface or whatever. It's supposed to be good for inflammation or whatever the fuck people use it for. But they're doing that. But they're doing it with they put a hornet inside the cup and then they stick it on to sort of her like plague wounds and stuff. It's gross. It's grotesque. And they're like, they're basically having a good time with it. They're like, yes, we will take the plague out of you using all this weird shit we're doing. And Grandier busts in the room. I was like, what the fuck is going on in here? And she sees it. Meanwhile, this woman dying of the plague who's laying there screaming and in agony. And he fucking starts pulling the fucking glass cups off of her body and throwing them at these quote unquote doctors. And he's like, you know, you've been using all this fucking bullshit medicine to try to save this woman and it hasn't done a fucking thing. And throws the sheet off of her and she's laying on her back, right, in this bed, but she's laying on top of a dead alligator. So he pulls this off and he's like, what the fuck is this? He like lifts up a full size dead alligator. Like, what the fuck is this? And they're like, it's supposed to be good for circulation or whatever. And he just throws it out the fucking window. And and great scene. It has to be seen to believe. But anyways, so the daughter of the dying woman was Madeline. The two of them fall in love and, you know, they decide to get married in secret. Okay, so he performs the marriage, and you know, this dude that this guy just, you know, you can tell when they look into each other's eyes that he's like, you know, he's like, you're an amazing woman, and I think you and I can kind of run off together, sort of thing. So they come back to the church where all the fucking nun orgy is taking place. And as soon as he gets there, he's like, fucking, what is this? What the fuck? This is the house of God, and you people are acting like fucking crazy assholes. What the fuck is going on? And he comes in, and they're basically like, look, the main nun said that you possessed everybody, and now everyone is in an orgy of, you know, satanic delights. You were named as the one that was responsible for this, so guess what? You're under arrest. So they take Father Grandier into custody. And after this, things move rather quickly. Let's see. Kind of all the nuns kind of disperse and go back to their devotions, their work or whatever. I mean, some do, some don't. It's a little weird. But Sister Jeanne, she's released. And, I mean, there's one point where she tries to kill herself. She tries to hang herself from a tree. And Lubardemont, like, runs and cuts her down before she could die. Where he's, you know, he's basically like, it's not up to you to decide when you die. That's our responsibility. We are the government, after all. So Grandier is basically held in custody in his, like, his really sweet, you know, kind of like head priest, you know, headquarters, and he's awaiting trial, basically. He's being held until he has a trial, and if he's found guilty, then he will be executed. And you already get a sense throughout the movie that the trial is probably not going to be the most fair and balanced trial that ever took place, ever. Which is another one of those things that sort of echoes in today's times, you know? So Granier is in his quarters. Labardamont comes in with all of his soldiers, and they're just destroying Granier's place. And they're probably looking for some type of evidence of his witchcraft, with his pact with Satan and whatnot. And, you know, Granier can't really do anything about it. He's sort of just laying back and just chilling while this is going on, because he really can't do much about it. So Labardamont says probably the most one of the most fucked up things you can say to somebody. Because at this point, Granier is just being held in custody. The whole, trial and torture and killing him part, we're not quite there yet. But Labardamont, before he leaves Granier's house, which is being completely destroyed, says this to him.
And I will pray for you.
You have one consolation. Hell will hold no surprises for you.
May God have mercy on us both.
And that is absolutely bone-chilling. So after this, we get our trial, which is really just, you know, they already know that they're going to kill Father Granier. They just want him to confess, sort of thing. But again, a giant, beautiful set, the sort of council of judges and religious elder people. They look insane. They look like Ku Klux Klan members, but with a giant red cross going across their face. And of course, every dirty trick possible is used during this so-called trial. False testimony from witnesses, using his own personal effects against him, the evidence of him having a marriage in secret, him fornicating in the presence of the church. Not good. As all evidence used against him, and, you know, the convent of Ursuline nuns being perverted and possessed by him. A lot of evidence, okay? And, of course, the testimony of Father Barre, he can just walk into a room and can tell who's possessed by the devil and who isn't. So after this, Granier is taken away. They shave off his really cool mustache. They shave his head. And he is found guilty and to be burned at the stake. Now, this whole time, they want him to confess to all of the charges against him, which he doesn't. He professes his innocence all the way till the very end. And, of course, Richelieu and Labardamont get what they want. They have full reign to, once Grandier is gone, to destroy Loudun, to tear it down. So they, after horribly torturing Father Granier, they bring him out to be publicly executed. And there's thousands of people there, right? There's Philippe, you know, the chick that he knocked up is there with her family, and everyone's laughing and cheering and having a good old time. It's like a fair. It's like a Renaissance fair or something. And everyone's having a great time because we get to watch someone get publicly executed. And they've basically broke Grandier's legs. So they kind of hobble him out to the stake. They tie him to the stake. The executioner tells him, like, hey, you know, if you want, I can just strangle you to death with a rope. And then you'll just go unconscious and then you'll suffocate and die. And, you know, so you don't have to be, you know, burned to death, you know, which was pretty cool. Pretty cool on the part of the executioner and everything. But Father Barre, Mr. Witchfinder, is not satisfied with this. They want him to confess. And still, before he's executed, he's all up in his face, spitting in his face, holding a cross, telling him to confess. And Grandier will not confess. So Father Barre takes it upon himself to light the pyre, you know, light the kindling that Grandier is strapped to. So everyone's singing and dancing and partying. Grandier's lit on fire, and as he's burning, he screams to the crowd, "Don't look at me, look at your city." Because it's like, while while everyone's been swept up in this whole trial and this public execution, what you are not seeing is there are powers above you that are going to tear your city apart. Okay, so while everyone's enjoying watching an innocent man be executed, what, you know, the sovereignty of your city is about to, well, in this case, be blown apart. So once the fires consume him, it cuts to Labardamont, and he's literally like, go! And you just see the walls of the city explode. And everyone panics, and everyone just flees for their lives, really. Hell of a scene. See a man on fire, you know, being burnt at the stake, and the walls of this mighty city being blown up. Just, they didn't even wait. They didn't even wait for the flames to die down before they're like, all right, he's dead. We're in control now. Boom. Tear the fucking walls down. So after this, we cut to Sister Jean in her convent quarters. And Labardamont comes in and he's like, all right, I got great news for you. Now that Grandier's dead, you're no longer possessed. Congratulations. And she says, what happened to Father Mignon? And Labardamont's like, oh, he's gone quite mad, actually. He keeps rambling on and on about an innocent man has been executed. So he's been imprisoned for the rest of his days. So, and then Father Barre went off to another town to deal with some other exorcism. And she's like, well, what am I supposed to do now? And he's like, oh, well, the city will be eventually destroyed and there'll be nothing left of Loudon. And that'll be the end of it. So at least you'll get some peace and quiet. And then he pulls out sort of a fractured head of a femur bone that's just charred black. So it's, you know, Father Grandier's. And she's like, oh my fucking God. And he's like, here you go, souvenir. And he just throws it on the ground. And it's kind of funny, but it's really morbid. And after this, we see sort of what's left of Grandier's ashes and his skeleton just being shoveled away with the rest of the rubble. The entire city walls are just crumbled to the ground. And Madeleine, who was Grandier's wife, is somehow still alive, and she crawls over the rubble and into the nothingness of what's left of Loudon. And that's basically the end. One point I want to, you know, one scene rather I want to point out was when Labardamont brings her the femur bone. and explains to her, like, oh, yeah, we're in control now. Granier's gone, which means the possession is gone. There is a scene that was cut out that was Sister Jeanne masturbates with the femur bone. So that's another scene that was removed from the original cut of the film. And, you know, given this movie, given the subject matter, and, I don't know, other movies of the time and movies that have come out since then, it's not the most shocking movie ever. I mean, it is shocking, I guess, on an intellectual level, because it definitely shines a light on things that are very relatable, that never really go away. Like, you know, religious oppression, political political corruption, you know, things of that nature, the sort of complicated nature between men and women and just existing in general. But hopefully someday Warner Brothers will remove their collective head from their ass and release the uncut version of Ken Russell's The Devils. And I absolutely love this film. It's amazing. I have a DVD copy of this. It looks like it was cobbled together somewhere in South Korea, since there's Korean written all over it. But you can also find a copy of this on like archive.org, along with interviews with BBFC censors, who are terrible people. They, you know, these people believe in fucking nothing. These people are assholes. But actually, real quick, if you want to see a fun movie during Halloween season, go check out a movie called Censor. It's a movie that came out in 2021, and it's about somebody who works for the British Censorship Board for movies, and it's an interesting little horror movie. Low budget, but original, interesting. I like it a lot. Just like The Devils. So please go out, find The Devils, watch it, and enjoy it. I love it very, very much. And that is the end of this episode. Thank you all for listening, and I will catch you guys on the next one. I don't know what the next episode is going to be, but hopefully I'll have one out sooner than later, and also have something up at Patreon at patreon.com/skeletonfactory, and send me a holler on Instagram at skeleton_factory. And I'm also on Twitter at SFPodcastATX. So with that being said, this is the Skeleton Factory Podcast, rescuing your movie night one movie at a time. I am Adam. I will check you all on the next one, and happy Halloween. Bye-bye.